They say that everything is bigger in Texas. It follows then that the task of convening rabbis in Dallas in order to learn, grow, and share with each other would be no small feat. Our dream for what we can accomplish here together is also oversized. On the one hand, we became rabbis in part because we love Torah, having the opportunity to study together at a high level in Chavruta and in fellowship is an all too rare gift that we hope everyone here will cherish. Through the study of sacred texts, we plan to probe the most fundamental and pressing issues facing the Jewish people today. By learning together in partnership, we will give and receive the necessary chizuk and support that we require before returning to serve our respective communities. On the other hand, our sages teach Imein Kemach Ein Torah. In the 21st century, our annual rabbinic convention must be more than a yeshiva shalmala. We must address the tachlis of our time, the practical realities tied to our sacred calling. So many of you, our colleagues, are doing wonderful work. We are innovating new programs, designing new concepts, creating new approaches and new paradigms. It's essential that our greatest successes not also be our best kept secrets. We hope that we will learn from one another as we learn with each other. What are the best ways we can bring Judaism to Jews? How can we best strengthen our communities, our congregations, our schools? How can we best deepen our relationship with God through prayer and spiritual practice? And how can we best foster a stronger connection to the State of Israel, a deeper commitment to Tikkun Olam, and a lasting association with Jewish peoplehood? What better place to try to pack this all in than in the fourth largest metropolitan city in the USA, Dallas, Texas, where our beloved colleague and incoming RA President Bill Gershon, we wish him a refuah shlema, he calls home and he welcomes us as well. This convention is an ingathering of big ideas and bold practices, a conclave of collective wisdom and shared inspiration. The outstanding staff of the Rabbinical Assembly has worked hard, tirelessly, alongside a dedicated committee of colleagues in order to make our Dallas dreams a reality. It was a tall order indeed for rabbis to come together to find time for both Torah Lishma and Torah Lamaaseh. My colleague David Rosen from Houston, Texas, who I remember welcoming us in Houston a couple of years ago, we both pray that together we can do both here in this great state of Texas. May we all go Michael L'chayel, and may we never stop striving to remain worthy of the sacred title we are all privileged to bear. Amen.
Amen.
Calling my colleague from the great state of Texas.
Thank you.
Remind you what the fourth largest city in America.
Houston. Houston's the fourth biggest city. Well, good afternoon, everybody. I'm David Rosen. I'm from Houston. I'm your colleague, Beth Yeshurun. And it's my pleasure to be here today. A special honor for me, if I may say so, to start, to work with Jonathan after working a number of years earlier when your father, Alvin, was, of course, president of the Rabbinical Assembly. We had the honor of serving together in my admiration for your father is such that I think he does deserve the better room. But I'm getting appreciation for you as well, Jonathan, because we worked together very closely over this past year. And you are a leader and a future leader, no question, of the Rabbinical Assembly. Part of what we wanted to do with this convention is not just to do Torah. There's so much wonderful Torah at this convention, like never before, thanks to the addition of the Hartman Institute coming to our community and being with us and the time you've allotted. But we also wanted to find some tachlis here, some ideas that work, so that we could come address those very issues that we're all dealing with, regardless of the sizes of our congregations and communities, and go home with some ideas that we can actually put into practice. The first idea that works is the one we're going to talk about today, ideas that we want to think about and hear about. is the idea of how we can transform prayer. One of the ways might be to have a beautiful mincha service like we just had moments ago. In my congregation, at the time we did mincha today, we would have done mincha, mari, had a kiddush, and been back for shachar. I mean, it was fast. It's fast. And anybody who comes to most of our chapels weekdays, well, you have to sort of hang on for the ride. And to have a beautiful, spiritual, meaningful, musical, well, that's what we want. That's what we're doing in conservative synagogues around the country on Friday nights. But there's other ways in which we need to expand prayer and turn it into something that can touch and resonate with so many of our members. We have a session today, and then we have two additional sessions on Wednesday, where we will be looking at... creating warm and welcoming communities and bringing in millennials and Generation Xers. These are, I think, the key issues that all of us are being asked by our officers at home to address. So we begin today with ideas at work when it comes to transforming and enriching Jewish prayer. Welcome, everyone. Baruch haba. Baruchim habayim.
So, good afternoon, everybody. The way we thought that we would work is we would each introduce ourselves and explain how it is that we were asked to participate in a conversation about transforming communal worship. So, I'm Amy Katz, and I think there are three things that I've done in my rabbinic career that have put me in the place of moderating this conversation. The first is that after my ordination, when I went and did a doctorate in education, I focused on teaching prayer to children in a supplementary school. And much of my research was about videotaping my teaching and watching it years later and sort of seeing my work as an artifact. And I think that gave me a certain kind of perspective on the whole notion of what it means to teach prayer and the difference between teaching prayer and praying with our children, and all sorts of issues came up there. When our family lived in Kansas City, I was networking as a pulpit rabbi, but I was a member of Congregation Beth Shalom, and in my lay capacity, the congregation was experimenting with a service called Tefillah 2000, and the congregational rabbis were busy in the main sanctuary, but I was the clay kodesh who worked with a committee to create an innovative kind of service that started at 10 and ended by 11:30, and it made all sorts of changes into the Matbea Shel Tefillah, the focus really being about creating meaningful or prayerful experiences, and recognizing that for this particular service, the Matbea was something that we could be very loose with. The rationale of the senior rabbi was there was a traditional service down the line for those who wanted it. And so I spent about 7 or 8 years really innovating and trying to create meaningful experiences. And finally, most recently, I've been very fortunate to be on the editorial committee for Sidur Lev Shalem. So much of my rabbinic career has been about creating different kinds of prayer experiences, and so I've thought a lot about it, and that's why I'm moderating the discussion. Each person on the panel is going to introduce themselves and say a little bit about what brings them here. Ed Feld is going to do a little bit more than introduce himself. He's also going to remind us a little bit about the origins of the Sidur to put this whole conversation in a context which seems particularly useful and important.
Thank you, Amy. I'm Eddie Feld. I was the senior editor of Matzah Lev Shalem, which now has sold 300,000 copies. I'm the senior editor of the new Sidur Lev Shalem, which is now being used on Friday nights in 70 congregations. It's quite something. I want to tell you what I have in mind for the Sidur and what the committee has worked on and what their dreams are for the Sidur. But to do that, I want to set it in a historical context. And I want to talk about first millennial Judaism. This is the first 1,000 years of the history of Jewish prayer. In the first 1,000 years of the history of Jewish prayer, if you would go to a synagogue in Eretz Yisrael, What would that have been like? We don't know very much about what it would be like, but we do have some hints. The historian of Piyut, Ezra Fleischer, says that when somebody came to a synagogue in Eretz Israel on Shabbat, they expected something new. Tfilah Chovah was weekday. Shabbat was a time when something new would happen. A piyut. A whole series of piyutim worked out through the Shema and the Amidah. The piyut in Eretz Israel was mostly about the parsha of that week. There'd be a chorus that would sing. And many piyutim, you can tell that they go back and forth between what a chazan might have said and what the kahal is being asked to say, because the lines of the chorus are very easy, and a chorus would have led them in that line. Shlomo Goitein says that the reason for the triumph of piyut was the music. So what was it like to be in a synagogue in Eretz Israel in the first millennium? We have only one letter of a chazan written around 1050 from Syria, sent to Cairo. And that's how it got into the Cairo Geniza. And he says in this letter, on Rosh Hashanah, I recited a new poem of Ibn Gabirol, and everybody clapped. So what people expected was the new, and they appreciated it. If you went to Babylonia, in a shul in Babylonia, on Shabbat, you would have only Tfilat Chovah. There would be a fixed liturgy. There would be no piyut. Piyut did not arise in Babel until the 10th century. 9th, 10th century. Sadyagon brought the tradition of Egypt to Babel. There's a little before Sadyagon. But otherwise, what you expected from davening was a straight davening. There was an exilarch in Babel, there were yeshivot in Babel, and in Babel you followed the law. In Eretz Israel, the Christians in 425 did away with the Nesiut, and every community did Ish HaYashar Ve'Einav Yaseh, and both communities flourished. We have two different models. The reason why Eretz Israel died out was because the Crusaders killed them. That it wasn't a tradition that grew stale. It was a tradition that was killed off. As there was a triumph of Babylonian Jewry, with the success of the Babylonian Talmud and its then taking over Northern Europe, which had not had the Talmud, the idea of fixity in Europe became greater and greater. We have 13th century, 14th century rabbis saying that you can't do the Sadya Gaon Arvit, which has a special Arvit for Shabbat, which we reprinted in First Fruits, which you all got. You can't do that because people will get mixed up. If they do something on Shabbat and something during the week, they won't be able to learn how to daven. So we need to have something fixed. And that tendency to fix more and more overwhelmed Ashkenazic Jewry. The last service that came in, the last new innovations in a traditional Sidur, were done by Luria, And it's not accidental that Luria coincides with the triumph of the age of printing. What the triumph of the age of printing means that Luria could add to Kabbalat Shabbat, right? Luria, by the way, didn't add to Kabbalat Shabbat. He davened just Psalm 29. It was his students who added it. Those people could add to Kabbalat Shabbat, but we have to do Kabbalat Shabbat. You should see what people wrote back to us about adding Shir Shirim, substituting songs other than these Mizmorim for Kabbalat Shabbat. We had ruined their Karl Bach service. What happens when Karl Bach becomes stale? What kind of sidur do we need in order for our services to be fresh? For our work as rabbis to be, that we put in as much work in preparing for Shabbat services and what tfilot are going to go into Shabbat services. What tunes are we going to use? How are we going to put together a service? What is going to be the arc of the service? What is it going to be its ups and downs? How much work should we as rabbis put into that and think of that as involving as much intentionality as anything else that we do in the rabbit? And what we ask, what we provide in the Lucidur, is ways of you doing this. Rabbis are busy. Rosenzweig said the problem with the German rabbinate was that they were overworked. The problem with the American rabbinate is that it's overworked. But within that, how do we make tefillah and the Shabbat experience fresh again so that it is not stale? Thank you.
So I'm Chanderbeck, and I'm wearing, I guess, three hats here. I'm here because I had the privilege of working with Ed on the committee on the Machzor, and I'm now also working with him as associate editor on the Sidur. And I'm here also because I'm a congregational rabbi. I have a very small congregation that is a little bit odd because it's a seasonal community. I'm out on the eastern end of Long Island in the Hamptons, and if you know anything about the Hamptons, it's a very unusual community. People are basically there in the summer, and they're basically there only on weekends. And what that means is that on the one hand, my congregation really is all about prayer. That's what we do. Because people aren't there during the week to do much more. They're in the city, they're in New Jersey, they're wherever they are. And it's enormously challenging because that weekend is packed with so many things, and it's the summer, and people have house guests, and tennis courts, and the beach, and golf, and benefits, and all these things they want to go to. And so it's a community where we really have to make prayer central, because if we don't have that, it's not compelling. There's no reason to belong to the shul. So prayer has really been, I've been there now 15 years, and it's really been my focus there. And out of our prayer experience, we have built a community that is sustained in this very strange, seasonal, up and down place, and that works. So I'll talk a little bit about that later. And the third hat that I'm wearing, and why I'm on this panel, is that I'm, as of this summer and fall, I will be the director of liturgical arts at the Jewish Theological Seminary. And so it's going to be my charge to start teaching some of what you just spoke about so eloquently, and hopefully to begin to marshal resources for all of us to be able to be more creative, to be more intentional and thoughtful about the kinds of services we lead, and how to make them meaningful in whatever setting we're in. That's why I'm here, and we'll talk about that.
I'm Bruce Dahlin from Denver, Colorado. I'm here with the associate rabbi of our congregation, Solomon Ruhwald. Our congregation is a suburban congregation. It has about 950 families, and it has an 80-year history. The cantor and I have been at this congregation for 20 years. For the first 10 years of that 20, we had very rapid growth in the congregation. Our service was basically chazanut. It lasted for 3 hours. Our cantor has a beautiful voice. I tried very hard to give good sermons, and it seemed to sustain itself for the first 10 years. We had good participation in service, good attendance, and so on. The last 10 years, we've been noticing something, and that is that seeing as the service has not changed really at all, and it hasn't changed for 80 years, it was feeling a bit stale, as you might imagine. It was feeling to us, certainly to the clergy on the Lima, as boring. We looked out and we saw our congregation disengaged in prayer, really just sitting there for about an hour and a half of the 3 hours. As you know, people come late. And we thought we needed to do something. Not only were there fewer people coming to Saturday morning services, but they were getting older. During the economic downturn, our congregation contracted in membership from about 1,000 families to 950 families. The president at that time grew very concerned, and as only presidents can do, he came up to me and he said, "Rabbi, you have to do something." And honestly, I had absolutely no idea what to do. One of the problems of being a pulpit rabbi is that you work on Shabbos, so you never get a chance to see other congregations. I've been in the rabbinate 28 years, and maybe 3 or 4 times in that 28 years have I seen another rabbi's service. So I really, honestly, have no idea what to do to revitalize this service or whether it could be salvaged at all. Heschel's comments, I think his comments to the Rabbinical Assembly, I think in the late 50s, that he said in our congregation, our services are so stale that they become like the boneyards of prayer. And we were certainly getting that sense in the Alliance, and we needed to do something. So I said to the president of the congregation that I needed a sabbatical, which I definitely did need after 25 years in the rabbinate. And he fought for me with the board, so it enabled me to take a sabbatical. And my mandate for the sabbatical is to go to some services around the country that were new, that were fresh, that over which there was a buzz. Go visit these congregations and see if I could bring anything back to revitalize our service. I took 4 months. I did visit many congregations around the country. Three in particular caught my interest. One was Hadar in New York. I'm sure many of you know Ellie Kopfer, our colleague, is involved in that tremendously vital service. Romamu in New York. Those from the East Coast probably are familiar with David Engbar and Romamu. And Ikar in Los Angeles, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with Sharon Brous's congregation in L.A. At those services, I saw an engaged laity. They tended to be shorter services, much more music, much more singing, and a kind of vitality and energy in the room. So I thought, after witnessing them, seeing them, and participating in them, that I could bring something like that back to our congregation. And when I got back to the congregation after 4 months, I had a plan to do just that. So we created a second service at our congregation. Amy mentioned something similar that she did in Kansas City. A second service, we had the traditional service that the congregation had gotten very used to over decades. And we had a second service that met in a separate venue, a youth center that we have on the site that has a top floor that has plenty of room for 120, 130 people. I took many of the melodies that I heard And I also took Ellie Comfort's advice. It was very good advice. He gave me a book by Joey Wiesenberg that is entitled Singing Communities. And I took Joey's advice in terms of putting a davening team, that's Sharon Brous's term, a davening team of singers together to begin this process. I invited about six people I knew who liked to sing to my living room with two or three of the melodies that I had heard on my sabbatical, and we sang together. And we sang together once a week for several weeks running, until we started to sound better, we started to trust each other's voices, and decided that once we had two or three tefillot in our repertoire, to begin to roll this out to the congregation. The first time we met, there were 40 people in the congregation, this was Saturday morning, that participated in our learning sessions. The second week, there were 80 people that showed up. And the third week, when we started to roll out an actual service, there were 120 people. For the remainder of this now two-year period, we've had between 120 and 200 people participating in this service. This service has a lot of energy. It's a very emotional place. We see people that are laughing. We also see people going through hardship that cry during the service. It involves lots of singing from the congregation. I would say if there's energy in the room, energy is coming from the congregation and not from the bima. We have a davening team that started out with six people but grew to about 18 people. We have two or three of those davening team members who are drummers, and they come virtually every Shabbat. So we have a lot of people that know the music very well. The music is simple, but it's new. And it has energy, and there's an enormous amount of energy and vitality in the room, which is contagious, which has helped us build this minion and sustain it for a two-year period. Something to understand very important about this service is that both rabbis of the congregation are completely invested in this service. It's not a once-a-month deal or every other week. It's every Shabbos of the year it meets. One of the two rabbis of our congregation leads that service, and the other leads the traditional service. We both prefer the second service. And I have to tell you that creating this service and sustaining it has been the most fun I've had in the rabbinate in 28 years. The most invigorating. It has revitalized not only our rabbinate, but it has revitalized the shul. The energy that comes off of this new minyan makes a difference in the shul. There's a community buzz about this minyan. Rabbis from the community that don't have pulpits attend this minyan. And one of the rabbis, who was a Reconstructionist rabbi, recently said to me, of all the things that come out of the Hebrew Educational Alliance, this is the last place I would have assumed would come up with this service. And he also said, you, Bruce, probably the last rabbi I would assume come up with this service.
So that's a good place to let Salomon come in so that others can...
Cause by the way, we don't say that out loud. The thing about how we like the other service better. We don't say that when we're at shul. But I'm Solomon Grunwald. I'm the associate rabbi at HEA. I was ordained in 2008 from the Ziegler School of Rabbinic Studies, and it's a pleasure to see teachers and colleagues and classmates here. When I interviewed in 2008 at HEA, I asked Bruce, what he described basically is our service, our main sanctuary service. One thing he forgot to mention is the shul was Orthodox until 20 years ago when he came. And the main sanctuary service is what I would call egalitarian Orthodox. I mean, it's mixed seating and women participate, but otherwise it is indistinguishable from an Orthodox service. When I interviewed, I asked Bruce, do you think that maybe in the future we'd ever have music here? Would there be some kind of alternative service? He said, absolutely not. Right? That's not what we are. That's not who we are. That's not what we do. And that was the end of the conversation. And then the economy tanked. And then there was a little bit more urgency to do something innovative. And when Bruce went on sabbatical, he first came to me to ask, you know, for my blessing, because it meant leaving me to mind the store for 4 months, in like my third year out. And I said, you can go on sabbatical, but you have to come back ready to shake things up. Like, we have, I'm not going to, like, 10 to 950 families, you know, for us to just keep doing the same thing. So, just by way of introduction, I just want to say that I think we're getting a lot of attention for this service, but at the same time, as Bruce said, we're not doing anything that I would say is terribly original. I mean, it's not. It's innovative, but it's not original. We're taking pieces of music from here and there. We're taking pieces of music from Romamu and Picard, all the places he mentioned. I think the context in which we're doing it is innovative. Being a large suburban shul, and given the history that we have, and I think the adaptive challenges that we've had to face, which I think we'll tease out as we go through this presentation. But what I want to say is that I think a lot of us are trying new things in prayer. And I don't know that we're doing anything that's so mind-blowing, but I look forward to exchanging ideas, and I think that it's really a great thing that the RA is starting this conference in this way on the topic of chaplet prayer.
So, thank you all. Bruce and Salomon began... They already told us a little bit about some of the experiments that they've been doing and how you got ready to do it. Jan, I wonder if you would sort of catch up a little bit and talk about some of the ways that you have innovated the communal worship and how you prepared yourself to do that.
So our service is actually a fairly, in some ways, straightforward document. It's a pretty full liturgy. We abbreviate it in the Zimmer, but it's pretty straightforward. And a lot of times I do it alone, because we're a small congregation, and that sometimes I have a student intern with me, sometimes not. What we've done, though, over the years is, certainly I play around with melodies a lot, and what I've been trying to create there, which I think has reasonably taken hold, is exactly the kind of culture that you were talking about, where there's an expectation that things will be different. So we have a kind of roster of melodies that we rotate through, and people sort of hold back and wait to see, are we going to do this prayer, are we not going to do it, are we going to do this melody, are we going to do that melody, which keeps it from becoming autopilot and gives me a lot of flexibility to try new things. The culture we've built is that expectation that things will change. And so, for example, when the Mansur came out, I could be very playful on High Holy Days in innovating in all kinds of new ways. And, you know, we started using English in different ways because the English was better. And I felt like I could, instead of feeling like, okay, I have to stop davening and give an English reading for the people who don't know the Hebrew, and then I'm going to go back to davening, I felt like I could actually daven some English. And so what we started doing, for example, was... flipping things around and letting the community respond with a Hebrew refrain while the person leading service, the student leading services with me and I chanted the English. And so we did this, for example, with the Anenu on the Eve of Yom Kippur. And we chanted the verse in English and the community responded, Hu Yanenu. Everybody can do that. And it was fabulous. We started, this past year, we did, with the Few of the Pew team, with one of us chanting the line in the Hebrew and the other one reading it almost simultaneously in English. We did it with a Pew that's there for Zikronot. And I will tell you that after Rosh Hashanah, the thing I got the most comments on from people in the community was that. Like if you'd asked me, would I ever in my lifetime see Zichronot as a high point for people in the service, I was floored. They loved it. We've been introducing some of the poetry, and I've been bringing poetry into Friday night and doing all these things. What I've learned from it, I think, is that the real issue with prayer is not what we sometimes think of as a problem of liturgical skill or Hebrew level, because my community is very mixed. And nor is it the length of the service. We have a 2.5-hour service on Shabbat morning in the Hamptons in the summer. And people come. The real issue is prayer. You know, the real issue is it prayerful? And I think that prayer is so countercultural today. I was affirmed in this notion of the Shabbat. I picked up a copy of a journal that Rabbi Mark Angels edited. I don't know if you know his organization that he started for the Orthodox world. And I happened to pick up the journal. The most recent one is on synagogues. And the articles in this journal could easily have been written by Heschel in the 1950s and addressed to us. And over again, person after person is writing, yes, we're an Orthodox community, people come, the shul is full, the room is full, there's no prayer going on. Right? And that's it's a knowledgeable community, that's not the issue. So my sense is that what has worked for us in Sag Harbor, and I think what has been in many ways so powerful about the Matzor and why we're getting the response we're getting to it, is that it's helping people to understand what prayer is about. Even as it's helping them, yes, there are commentaries that help them understand the liturgy, but there are comments that help them understand what's supposed to be happening when I pray. And I think it's so countercultural today in so many ways that we need to teach it. We need to make it explicit, we need to model it. And when it works, when it's happening, my sense is that people know it when they see it. And that there's a hunger for it that they haven't yet been able to name. But when they feel it, they say, oh, I want that. I want that. I don't even know what that is, but I know I want it. And I don't know why that was different from what I did. I can't tell you what made it work, but I know it worked for me differently. And my feeling is it doesn't matter if they know why. I mean, eventually people start to learn, but it's less important that they know why than that they experience it. The one last thing I want to say about what I think I've learned from all this is not to underestimate people's capabilities. I feel so strongly about this that I'm concerned about dumbing things down, and I am 100% all for accessibility and inclusiveness. When I dial in the community, I always announce page numbers. I always have transliteration available. Now it'll be in the sudor. But that's different from suggesting that prayer should be easy. Or avoiding some of the difficult theological concepts and some of the real challenges of prayer. Or presenting kind of a challenging music sometimes. Because I do worry that we're about blurring the line between prayer and entertainment. And if we do that, prayer becomes entertainment, ultimately it's not going to work. It will work for a little while. You know, there'll be a buzz and it will bring some people in, but there's a risk of creating experiences that are so easy to enter, demanding nothing, that they're also very easy to leave because they offer nothing. So it's a very delicate balance, I think, between bringing the community in and then moving them deeper and not leaving people at an entry point that doesn't offer enough to sustain it. And the truth is, I think trends change. You know, I mean, you're right about it. Karl Bach is already, I bet, living on the Upper West Side of New York. It's already on the way out. Right? It's not, I'm personally bored with it already and looking for something else. And when that happens, have we taught a deep enough understanding of what it means to pray that we can evolve again and move to the next thing and not get stuck in what became the latest greatest fashion?
So I want to add a sort of a piece to that, and this is an experience I've had as a rabbi who's been running services for years, and it actually has to do with when we have those special moments in the congregation, like when a couple is celebrating their 50th anniversary, when somebody has been ill and it's time to bench Gomel, and The truth is, I stumbled on this, I must say, because I forgot my rabbi's manual at one point or another when it was time for such a service. But I've learned actually to leave the rabbi's manual behind almost any time that I want to name a particular moment. I've learned to try and be spontaneous, not to try, to be spontaneous. And whatever it is I have to say will not be as eloquent as it was if I had were reading a prepared text that I spent hours in front of the computer writing. But what I've noticed is it's more genuine. And I've noticed that people hear that. And so I've actually taken this notion of saying, part of what I'm doing is modeling how to be prayerful in the moment. And what I've learned about myself is that when I'm reading from a text, I'm not as present as when I'm thinking about what I'm saying in the moment. This can lead to many an embarrassing moment for me because I either have to think about what I want to say and I pause for a moment to find the right word. And often I cry. We did a baby naming last Shabbat and I was just became very verklempt thinking about the 8 great-grandparents and the 4 grandparents and this little baby, and there they were, and I couldn't help it. And it was like, really, I was embarrassed. My children were particularly embarrassed. But I think, actually, several people came up to me and said, it meant so much more to me. And so a piece of what I've learned is to leave the rabbi's manual in my office and to know that I've learned what's there. And I have to say, I learned it from my Christian clergy friends because I watched them. And when Pastor Paul Brooks could make me cry doing his version of Emotzi, I knew that there was something I needed to learn from him about prayer. What I wanted to ask all of you to think about, talk about a little bit now, though, is the challenges you've encountered. What I thought we would do is do the challenges and maybe share a proud moment. And then I want to open it up for you to ask questions. So challenges, proud moments. And I guess the last thing I'm also going to ask you to think about is how you juggle sort of being innovative with this mandate to be faithful to the tradition. But first let's do challenges, then proud moments, and then the juggling back and forth. And I think we have time for those sort of 3 categories. And I don't want to put anyone on the spot, so whoever wants to jump in, challenges first.
I'll jump in. Okay. The challenges were enormous. I came back from sabbatical with new ideas. But many people in the traditional service didn't want to hear those new ideas, especially as we focused a lot of rabbinic attention on this new service. People in the main sanctuary felt a little bit abandoned. They felt neglected. They were wondering why we needed a second service. They were concerned that we were splitting the shul. They were concerned that the people who went to this new service were freeloaders. At one point, someone called the new service Goyish. At other points, is reform or reconstructionist in the negative sense. So we had an enormous pushback at the beginning of the process. But we found that as time went on, it's been going on for 2 years now, as time went on, the detractors started to lessen a bit. Even some of the more vocal detractors started to see the rationale in it. They started to see the energy that was coming to the rest of the congregation from this minyan, and saw that there was a success happening in their congregation, which certainly wasn't splitting the congregation. All of those concerns were just not true, and started to come around.
I think for me, one of the biggest challenges, one is that I get bored more quickly than my community does. And I have to check myself from switching up the melodies as often as I'd like to and provide enough stability for them while still praying authentically myself. And I really see it as a challenge because if I just give them what they need and I'm not davening, then the whole thing falls apart. Fortunately, I think they get that. And so we struggle with that. The other real challenge is that, you know, for everything I said that I think there's a real hunger for this and I don't want to underestimate the community and I really do think that more people than we think are ready for this. There are people who just don't want it and are just not. And they're not coming to services because they want to pray. They're coming for entirely other reasons. And it's been hard for me personally to just live with that. And not feel crummy about it and not try to change them. And at the same time also keep enough of a primary culture in the room that that doesn't carry the day. And that, I think, is to go to the thing I felt the greatest victory. I remember the moment, the year, when, having started this little community in Sag Harbor, when the Shabbat energy carried over for the first time on the High Holidays. Because, you know, week after week, we would build on this community, we had this intimacy, and it was fabulous, and the prayer energy was great, and then the High Holidays would come, and it was like a whole different thing. And one year, we had grown deep enough and held. And the people who were coming just for the holidays, who really had no idea about prayer, actually experienced something and went there. And everyone in the room felt it. And it took, I would say, 4 or 5 years to get there. But the moment we got there, I felt, wow, like now we really have a prayer community.
I think that the notion that a siddur can offer choice, and that when you open up a siddur, you don't have an expectation that you will say everything from beginning to end, is sometimes difficult for people to mediate. And my own vision of a piece of what we're doing in the siddur is that we are not a traditional Orthodox siddur, we're not a Reform siddur. We represent a maturation of the best of the conservative movement, which is that we incorporate a variety of Jewish traditions. We understand that there isn't a single tradition which is our spine, but rather a totality of tradition, which is our spine. And that making those choices within the tradition and fed by the tradition is, in fact, a way of living Jewishly that we advocate.
So, Amy, I'll save a little time and talk about the triumph and the challenge that have been the same. One of the things that we did was really empower our lay leadership, both the singers that Bruce talked about, but also we have a group of lay leaders who are sort of an advisory council, so to speak, for this service. We gathered them together early on when we were developing it, and many of them were Wexner alumni, people that we knew had been really engaged in Judaism and had a lot to say about it. And we posed to them the question, if we could start a service from scratch, like take no assumptions, like none of this, like this is the way we've always done it, let's dream together. Let's dream big about what a really vital spiritual service could look like together. And they helped us dream together. And they've also become a core of volunteers that just step forward and make the whole service happen, all the logistics of it. Same thing happened with the Daveners. Who've come forward, and as Bruce mentioned, there are now 18 people on the davening team. So both of those pose a challenge as well, though, because lay empowerment means there are a lot of cooks in the kitchen, a lot of people wanting to give their opinions, and a lot of great energy, a lot of creative energy, and sometimes that's hard to manage. Same thing with the daveners. Our current challenge now is how do we balance our desire for really excellent musical experience, and at the same time we want to be really inviting and democratic and kind of egalitarian, and we've allowed a lot of people onto the davening team, and ranging, by the way, from the age of 9, our youngest member, the 2 members are 9, and we have a couple of members in their 70s and even 80s, I think. And it's a great group. But now we're starting to get to the point where we need them to do a little tzimtzum and be able to step back and maybe allow other people who want to sing to come in. They feel very proprietary now about the service, and sometimes when we want to make changes, they say, but we love that melody. We can't change that melody. You know, and one of our guiding principles has been to create a culture of experimentation where nothing is taken for granted, and where keva is a vehicle for kavanah. It can't be We can't be subservient to Keva, but Keva is important as a vehicle for what we're trying to achieve in terms of Kavanah. And I want to just also piggyback on a couple of these comments and say I think we're uniquely positioned in the conservative movement to do this, and it's not surprising to me that a lot of the innovators out there who are getting a lot of attention are coming from conservative Judaism. Because we are deeply rooted in tradition, and that gives us a place of authenticity to work from that really speaks to people. Our service is almost entirely in Hebrew, and yet most of the songs don't require you to know more than about 8 words. You know, and if you can repeat what the people up front are singing, then you can daven, and you feel good, and you feel like you can daven too. And we've really tried to model that empowerment, both of the lay people and volunteers and the congregation, and it's very collaborative in that sense.
So as we move to talk about this question of a proud moment or victories, when a moment when you knew what you were doing was really touching someone's life, I actually want to share with you all a story, but in this instance, I was the receiver. Back in December, I was spent Shabbat actually with Rabbi Gordon Tucker, and this particular Shabbat, he does a contemplative service, I don't know, a couple of times a month, and usually it's an alternative, but for whatever reason, this particular Shabbat, it was the service. And of course, I had gone to services with Gordon on Friday night and then again on Shabbat morning, and I should say that when I arrived at Gordon's, I was sort of as broken and as parched as a rabbi could be, aside from some things that were going on in my personal life that were very draining. I had officiated at 3 horrific funerals within a 3-week period. I mean, like a car accident, a very young person. I mean, it was like, and I'm a solo rabbi and my cantor is part-time. So I was feeling, as you all have in your own time, the weight of the world on my shoulders, in a way that when I got there, I was so ready to be away from everything. So I went to services on Friday night, and I have to say they were like, okay, Friday night services. My favorite service of the week is Friday night. I was looking forward to the Kabbalat Shabbat that would just lift me, and you know, it was Friday night. The schnapps after was good, but that's another story. But then Shabbat morning, we went to this, Gordon did this contemplative service, and I was like, one thing I love about being a pulpit rabbi is I get to figure out when the service is over. So I was really thinking, how am I going to sit here? He had a class from, I want to say 8:30 to 9:30, and then the service was from 9:30 to 12:30, and I'm thinking, oh golly, this is going to be a long morning. I'll go for a walk at some point. Well, I sat down for when services began, and Gordon took us through this very beautiful, very transformational service. I didn't look at my watch once. At one point, I had an aliyah, and he called me up, and I don't even really know what he said, but it's not going to surprise you. I felt the tears here, and by the end of the service, I was a different person. And I wrote about it for my congregation, actually. I sent them an email talking about the rabbi's rabbi. And I talked about how this contemplative service, it really looked like a lot like our services, but had some kavanot and had some teaching and had a little bit of a different kind of singing, just lifted me. And I literally, I'm telling you, when I was in the service, I felt broken. And when I left, I felt whole. I don't really know how to describe it, but I will say that Shabbat morning really changed me. And the reason that I want to sort of compare that to the Friday night is I had expected that on Friday night. Like, I was planning on Friday night having that happen. And the Friday night was kind of we went from one psalm to the other. It was a very, you know, uninspiring, just like a Kabbalat Shabbat service, like we've all led. I've led it myself. You know, I'd never criticize Gordon publicly. I think he's the best. It was just a Friday night service. But the Shabbat morning service was extraordinary for me. And the only thing that made me feel badly was during the Kiddush lunch when Gordon was introducing me to some people. Several people said, oh, I wouldn't go to that service. You know, it was sort of a too touchy-feely for me. And that was sort of like the sad piece for me, because I thought it was this beautiful service. How could you not go? But it goes to your point, Bruce, about, you know, people having their fears. But I share that with you. If Gordon gets to the service, he knows how I felt about it. But it would have been a proud moment for him. I know it was, because it was exactly what we want our worship to do it, it lifted someone who came in feeling very broken and made me feel very whole by the end. And I wondered if you would share your version of those stories. And I, obviously they'll look different, but I think they're important to hear.
I would say there were two trials in the last 2 years that really meant a lot to me and to the congregation. The first was when we started the singing group in my living room. For the first time in Tefillah, at my synagogue, we could hear each other sing. We could hear each other's voices, and we kind of came together as a kind of unified whole when we did the Tefillah. Because for the last 20 years, the only voice that we could hear on the Bima was the Chazan's voice. And we can't, at least on the Bima, hear the voices of the people in the congregation. It's always, his voice is beautiful, but it's always the loudest, and it's always operating, so to speak. And this time, in my living room, I could hear other people sing, and it was uplifting. It was just amazing. And for Shir Chadash, which is the name of our service, that's been one of the guiding principles, that we need to be able to hear the person next to us sing. So there's no loud voice coming from the front. Even though there's a large davening team, the idea is to be able to hear the person next to you sing and be a part of that kind of unified experience. The other real triumph of the past year and a half is we tried to do this for the High Holidays. And Sal and I, we had no idea what to expect. We went to the church. We needed a big venue, so we went to the church just down the street from us. It was a mega church. It had a very big venue. We thought we'd have about 200 people, maybe. We have 120 on Shabbos, maybe 200. People would show up. We were going to rope off the sides so that people would all sit in the middle and towards the front so we could all hear each other. On the first day of Rosh Hashanah, there were 600 people. On the second day of Rosh Hashanah, also 600 people. And on Yom Kippur, there were 800 people. The church only held about 650. So we were spilling out into the lobby, and people were standing and were part of this service on the High Holidays, which was a great triumph, as Jan said, from going from Shabbat, something that was so Shabbat-oriented, to the High Holidays.
One thing that we do at Shir Chadash is we invite people who are taking an aliyah to introduce themselves and to say a few words about why they, what occasion it might be, or what they're dedicating the aliyah to, what's something that's on their mind. And those have been some incredible moments. Every week there's somebody who makes everybody cry, you know, and there's somebody who's celebrating something and they feel so good being up there and telling everybody about it. And those have been really amazing moments of where people, it feels like testifying. I mean, they're testifying spiritually about what's happening to them and in their experience in the service, and that's been very gratifying. And I think the other thing is, as Jan, I wanted to also reflect on this with you, Jan, because you were saying a little bit about you don't know why it worked, and I think, I wonder, maybe you can reflect back, for us what worked is that it worked for us. Right, there was a certain spiritual selfishness in what we did. We did it collaboratively with a lot of other people who also had a vested interest and lots of opinions about how we were doing it. But it had to. We weren't going to be the rabbis who didn't like the job in their own service. Right? It had to work for us spiritually. And then the attitude that we had was we were inviting everybody to join us in this experience. Now, that doesn't mean that we dictated it. But it does mean that they saw in us how it moved us, and that it was a spiritual experience for us, and they reflected that back to us, and have continued to do that. And as Jan said, I think the message that I want to share with all of you is, you know, kind of chazak ve'amatz, you know, like, don't be afraid of the change, because We were very fearful, and we got a lot of pushback at first, and it was very tempting to back down. Bruce was very strong and resolute that we weren't going to. And at the same time, you know, it was kind of like, it made me think about like Steve Jobs, the Hub deal. We didn't invent the iPhone, but Steve Jobs was always driven by the idea that he was going to bring products to the market that people didn't even know they wanted, right? And until they saw it. And we didn't know how people would react to the service, but as soon as they saw it, they wanted it. And what I want to say is that I think there's a pent-up demand and need and a yearning and a longing for spirituality out there in our congregations, if we're just willing to tap into it and open it up and let people sort of pour it out. And it is there, and you can withstand the resistance and the pushback, because if you're sincere and in what you're doing, people will see that.
I want to tell two stories. The first story is my first High Holidays service from my first position as Helen Director of the University of Illinois. And a woman came up to me, because the community joined us for services, a woman came up to me at the end of the service and said, "I've been going to Jewish services for 18 years. She was a convert. "I've been going to services for 18 years, and this is the first service I wasn't bored at." And I thought to myself, "Yidden, they're willing to come for 18 years until they call me." You know, they're great people, these Jewish people. The second story is, in our congregation in Northampton, I'm not the rabbi, I'm a dues-paying congregant. We used First Fruits for Friday night services, one of the test congregations. And at the end of the service, we asked for reactions, and somebody called out and said, "Shira Shirin was what was missing for me, and is the final thing which helped put together what Kabbalat Shabbat is." And it's really thrilling that we can do something and pull it together for people in a way which makes them feel that this is Shabbat, this is Tefillah, this is what they were looking for.
I just want to add, so we've also been using First Fruits, and when we started to use it, our cantor, who knew that I was on the committee, said, "Why did you put Shira Shirin between the sounds?" As many of you actually wrote in faith, right? And really, what were you thinking? And I tried to explain the logic, and I said to you, "Remember, this is an experimental edition. Hold tight, sit with it, try it. The world isn't going to be broken if we decide to change it, but let's try it." Last Friday night, she says to me, now we've been using it since December. She says to me, "I really like Shir HaShirim between the sounds. It really works." And I thought, no, so you tried it for, 4 months is all we're talking about. And for me, it was because if you could have seen how upset she was that it was there in between the sounds, because it's so much easier to go from, the end of one sound to the beginning of the next. And now sometimes we have to turn a page because we don't do every piece of Shir HaShirim. But it really actually was a reminder to me about like the patience to try something new. And, when I told her about Eddie's experience in Northampton, when she first complained, she said, "I don't know how anybody could feel that way." And I chuckled 4 months later. She says, "I really like it." So the last thing before we open for questions is I know this is an issue that I struggle with all the time, and I think I began it in rabbinical school because I was really to the left of most of my colleagues or fellow students at the time, which is I always like worry that the founders of the conservative movement are looking at me and saying, "What is she doing? And where are the standards? And where is the halakha? Or where is the tradition?" I always worry about it. I sort of see my teachers coming into my sanctuary and think, "Oh my God, what are they thinking?" And actually, it's one of the reasons I loved working with Alan Cohn when I worked with him in Kansas City, because there was somebody else there. So now I kind of worry because I'm the senior rabbi, and so I think, oh, please, I want to be true to the tradition and I want to innovate. And that is always, I'm always sort of the imposter thing. It's my bag. It's a therapist will help me figure it out one day. But I don't know if you guys have had those struggles and how you manage it. But I worry about that a lot and feel that tension. And I wonder if you do and then what you do with it.
So I do. And I have to say, I'm going to share this, that throughout our work on the Matzah and now the Siddur, we always start with a prayer that nobody comes to error because of us. So there is that sense of yirah, right, of awe. And I feel that way when I teach. I feel that way when I dine, and that, you know. There are a couple of things I try to keep in mind. One is I really try to keep the Kor Mitzvot of Tefillah front and center and not lose the forest of the trees. I really try to think about Hodesh Balev, about, you know, Kabbalah Omach Shemayim, as being like of what it's really about, and not get so lost in the particulars that I lose that. The other is to remember that, you know, that, like that old joke about, you know, was the tradition to sit or stand, but the Shema, we're fighting about it, you know, that's the tradition, right? But the tradition is a tradition of innovation. The tradition is a tradition of experimentation and of, you know, I think of myself as a spiritual adventurer when I found them. And that means it matters. You know,
that's great.
I'll wander into places I wish I hadn't wandered, and I'll come back. And it's okay. Like I try to allow myself that risk of trying something with the idea that the experimentation is itself deeply authentic. Even if the particular expression in that moment turns out to be something I'm not going to do.
I like that. That's beautiful. And I'm going to use that. Trust me. We have a traditional service, so that eases my guilt a little bit. If my professors step into Shir Chadash, I also would think, what must they think of me? But then I look at our traditional service and I say to myself, how's that working for you? And it just is not working for me, for the cantor, for the associate rabbi, and I know for the congregants. So we can continue to do what we're doing and see less and less people, less and less engagement, or we can make innovation. As guilty as I sometimes feel, we don't do a Haftorah, we don't do Musaf. As bad as I feel about those things, I just know, just deep in my gut, it's the right thing to do.
So I want to ask if there are questions out there, because we really... So if there are microphones there, I don't know how to... Why don't you just walk to the microphone so the people can hear you? Yeah. If you get in line by the microphone, that would be great.
Say who you are and where you're from.
Perfect. Thank you, Susan.
Hi,
you have to just turn it on.
Hi, everyone. I'm Eddie Bernstein from Boynton Beach. Thank you all for a thought-provoking presentation. I had kind of a brainstorm while listening to our Denver colleagues. Confession, I was a little off task and I was looking at something online, and I decided to go to the Hebrew Educational Alliance website because I thought that maybe there would be the melodies I didn't see it there, so I think it would be really cool if the melody, if you could get the your davening team to record those melodies and to post them online. And then I was thinking it would be cool if other congregations did that, and that if the RA could provide a portal on our RA website with links to all the different
great. Thank you.
For the softball question. Our website is terrible, and in a matter of weeks it will be switching over, and I think we'll have those capabilities. And we are actually right now in the midst of recording our music in a professional studio, and we're getting some of it up. I have a SoundCloud account for people who want to. I have the melodies already up on SoundCloud, and I can give you that link if you email me. But yeah.
Can I just add, the RA has already started putting some sound files for new music for Lev Shalom on the website, so that's already at least begun somewhere.
Rick Spiegel from Thousand Oaks, California. Thank you. This is a great presentation today, really great. How do you deal with what many of us who aren't up in some factories? How do you deal with big congregations where half, three quarters of them are not your members? A lot of them aren't even Jewish. Some of them don't open their prayer books. They don't open their chumash. How do you deal with that whole structure of week in and week out bar mitzvahs, which we can't cancel, we can't push them aside? How do you deal with that and try to be spiritual at the same time?
So I just actually want to say, I want to jump in. Back in Kansas City when we did this Tefillah 2000 service, it was very successful. One of the problems was it was so successful that bar and bat mitzvah families wanted to have their simcha in that service, and we actually realized it didn't work. That putting the bar and bat mitzvah service with the Tefillah 2000 sort of broke it in a way. So we kept them separate. And at first when I took my pulpit in Temple Beth El in Springfield, I was kind of feeling sorry for myself because we only had about 20 or 25 bar and bat mitzvahs a year, and I was feeling like, oh, I should be at a shul that's more dynamic with a younger community. Now I actually feel really blessed because it turns out, it turns out that my Shabbos communities, we can develop a real rhythm with our Shabbos communities, and like all of you, are the families that come all the time, it feels really great. And I just know that there are, I can tell you which ones where it's just not going to feel as great. And part of what I do is, my cantor and I work together, and I pitch my sermon knowing it's a bar mitzvah. And so I know that I'm throwing to the folks who are not out there. And it's happened many a time where I had a Devar Torah idea, and I thought, this is not a Devar Torah for a bar mitzvah. It's too sophisticated. I don't mean that in a, that doesn't sound nice, but it's too much for people who come every week. This is a Devar Torah. You have to be doing a Devar Torah for people who come once in a blue moon. And I have to say that that has really pushed me to think long and hard about the teaching that I'm going to do. And I've talked to our cantor about thinking about when she wants to introduce new tunes and when she doesn't, and to sort of say, let's bring them in a way. And so we're very deliberate. And the last piece is that I work especially hard to sort of use my own English and the comments that I make for the bar and bat mitzvah. Like, I'm really careful not to go into the rote mode. I'm careful about it anyway, but I'm more so at a bar and bat mitzvah because I realize that the congregation can feel more like an audience, and I have to really work to pull them in. And that's my piece.
To answer your question, we don't allow B'nai Mitzvah at Shir Hadash.
So I think that's what we learned that right at Kansas City.
Yes, we don't allow it because it would ruin the service. It changed the nature of the service, with one exception. And the first exception is going to be June 6th. A member of our davening team, who was 12 years old when she joined, is turning 13. So her and her family have been integrally involved in Shir Hadash. So we're going to have her bat mitzvah. Everybody knows her. They've been participating from the beginning. And that is going to be the standard that we use moving forward. If there's a family who is involved in Shir Hadash for years, and I'm not talking about 6 months, but seriously for years, then we'll consider having that bat mitzvah. Otherwise, they go to the main sanctuary.
But I can just add very briefly that I think that the other big project I'm working on in the shul is reimagining bar and bat mitzvah. Okay. And maybe part of the answer to that question is maybe we need to rethink bar and bat mitzvah from the ground up because we all know what it does to our services. Sometimes it's great, but oftentimes it's the bar mitzvah thing.
So let me just say, I know that the next thing starts at 5 o'clock, movement leadership working together. I'm going to take just about, we're going to finish by about 5 to 5 so that people can get there. If you don't want to stay for this, no one, oh, it's here, so that's even better. But no, because we started late, and I feel like questions need to be asked because that's really important. So,
My name is Daniel. I'm from Bridgeport, Connecticut. I know I'm asking a CDOR committee the following question, but my question is, do we want to facilitate the use of a book or facilitate the non-use of a book? Because so many would say that if you have a book in your hands, you can't dance, you can't clap, you can't get up and move. So I guess one practical piece is, would you be interested in making a new lay shutting studio that you could project on a screen so that people could job in with it with their hands free and their feet free? What do you do about the use of a book in dabbing?
I'll leave that to you, Ed.
So our designer tells us that the kind of design that we have at the moment with the current technology cannot easily be translated to, let's say, a tablet form or that kind of projection form, because we just have too much on it. We have too many columns, too much on a page that's going on, and it would have to be reconceived entirely for this to be technologically feasible in the way that you're describing. We're at a very early moment in technology, and I genuinely don't know what's going to happen, whether we'll still be a community which has books at services or something else will happen. My own inclination is that there's a great advantage to a book. I mean, now I may just be old-fashioned about this, but what a book allows you to do is to enter into your own experience. What the projection does is demand that you be with the community for everything. What a book does is allow you to go in and out of the community, in and out of the self. And I personally am not wanting to give that up.
Let's just not say the projection, just say closing the book. Not just putting it on the screen, just closing the book. I mean, can we facilitate that, the person who closed the book and
Yeah.
We use the same Shalom Zidur, but I have to tell you that my copy is all beat up because I'm clapping with it. But I've often found I often just put it down on my chair when we're singing in the room and so on. Because I like you, find it more problematic than helpful.
Elliot?
Hi, I'm Elliot Gore from American Jewish University.
Your mic's down.
Not my thing.
Can you say your name again?
No, is this on now? Yes, it is. So first of all, as a former teacher of four of the five of you, I should redeem guilt. Okay? That's my first job. Okay. I'll give you a sign though. I think one of the real issues is that prayer is the most complicated and complex phenomenon of Jewish life that exists. It's much easier to understand what kashrut is, what moral norms are, what Shabbat is, than it is to talk about what prayer is. And part of the reason for that is that that prayer has a variety of different levels to it and a variety of different goals. The way that I put it in the book that I did, Knowing God, is that it's like playing baseball, right? You get a home run over the right field fence, over the center field fence, over the left field fence, and pro ball, even inside the park home run, right? And you can get up, and most of the time, you're not going to get a home run. You're going to get a base hit, if that. 333 is a really good average for a pro ball, you know? So one out of three times, if you just get a base hit, that's pretty good. Okay? And then the question really is, now for rabbis, what is your goal in a particular prayer service? I've heard three or four of them over the conversation, right? One is a musical experience. I grew up in a congregation that got the Solomon Schechter Music Award 10 years running because Max Janowski came up to Milwaukee and taught a choir of 70 adults and 30 teenagers. And every Friday night, one or the other of those choirs was leading prayer. It was all the Lewandowski melodies, and we were singing along, right? It might be an aesthetic experience. I heard another goal of prayer is to take me when I'm broken and make me whole. Right? That's a very different goal with very different programming for that goal. I heard another goal that was being talked about is that you have a spiritual experience. First of all, you have to define what you mean by spiritual. This is the philosopher in me, I'm sorry. Okay? But then you have to figure out what that is. I heard a fourth goal. This is Kabbalah Omahut Shemayim. Well, how do you do that? Right? If that's your goal for prayer, then what is it that you do in order to make that happen? Right? What do you mean by God in the first place? And then how do you understand Kabbalat Olam Hushamayim? My point is simply that prayer by its nature has all of these goals involved. And if you want to have, quote unquote, a successful prayer service, you have to define what your goal is in the first place.
Fair enough.
Thank you for absolution. It means a lot.
I think this should be the last question because I see the other presenters are here.
Okay. My name is Stephanie McCammon. My congregation is in Northfield, Illinois. Just want to share a great resource. I've become the groupie for Nava Tehillah, which is a prayer group out of Jerusalem. Some of you may have heard them there. It's navatehillah.org. They have, the music is incredible. It's very usable in North American congregations. Because it's taking the, you know, 8 words and repeating it over and over. It's beautiful. It's exciting to me that the music innovation coming out of Jerusalem Tshuva. They give all their music away for free, though I suggest you make a donation anyways.
I just jumped in.
Navatehillah.org.
Yeah.
With an H. I think it's Navatehilla.
You can find it. You can find it.
You can find it. It's easy. They sell their CDs. They're great.
I wanted to respond to my classmate. and relieve his guilt. for raising that question. I think that the goal is to let people do what they need to do. That is, I'm not so in favor of services that are so directed that I can't be let into my own space. Part of what music does is it's different than words in letting you do that. In that sense, music is not a goal, music is in part a means. It's the means of help letting you bypass a certain rational part of your brain to get to an imaginative part of the brain, which is very important in Tefillah. It is a communal experience, but it's also lets something happens inside that gets you past the words. So and that's. To let what needs to come up for each person come up. So we, as service leaders, are creating conditions in which we might touch various points and various modes and various emotions, because who knows what, who needs this and who needs that, and we may need a variety of things. I think we're all brokenhearted, and if we can somehow allow our brokenheartedness to get massaged a little, that's what happens in truth.
So the irony of this session is because Mincha was put into it, we didn't have an hour and a half, and so we have to end early, but that actually is always our tension, and we're not ending early, we're ending late. I apologize. We're here to answer questions, and thank you all for coming.